Today's podcast is once again brought to you by our friends at Dying Breed Music. If you don't know about Dying Breed, they keep getting classic Gibson and Martin acoustics from the golden era, and they're doing a great job at it. Lane currently has a 1939 Martin D18, a 1951 Gibson J185, and a 1941 Gibson L00 all for sale. He is always up for consignment, so you can give him a call at 870-818-3434 if you have something in your closet that you're hoping to sell. He is also great about answering any and all questions you may have about the stuff in his inventory. So give him a call or check out his inventory at dyingbreedguitars.com and tell him the Fretboard Journal sent you. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal's 140th podcast. This week I'm talking to Doug Cower, the mastermind behind not only Cower guitars, but also Titan guitars and DRS racks. Doug is a good friend. I truly love his electric guitars. I think his Titan line is truly something special. And his overall just design sensibility and attitude is really refreshing. So check out his work if you can. It is great stuff. The Titan guitar is a tremendous value for an American-made electric guitar. You should check those out too. This was a fun chat. There are kids screaming in the background, but I hope you like it. We are about to send our 39th issue of the Fretboard Journal to the printer. If you have not subscribed yet to the Fretboard Journal, I hope you will. You can do that at fretboardjournal.com. We are a reader-supported magazine. That means minimal ads and great production. So you will have a ton of editorial in every issue to wade through without having to hop over all those tiny little quarter-page ads you see so often in magazines. I'm really proud of what we've assembled in our next issue, as well as what we have cooking for Beyond. I will spill the beans that Nels Klein wrote a mammoth feature for us in issue 39, interviewing one of his heroes. It's incredible. I hope you will subscribe, and we will send it to you just as soon as it is done from the printer. We always have a wide array of electric and acoustic instrument builders in each issue, all telling their stories. Everybody's got a unique tale. It's great. If you like our podcast, you will definitely love our magazine. And if you like our podcast, one more encouragement to go on to iTunes, leave us a review. If you like a particular episode of the podcast, please feel free to share it on Facebook and social media. We love getting the word out on these, and it's certainly nice to go onto Facebook and not just see political posts, but fun guitar-related posts, because we all need a distraction sometimes. All right, without further ado, here is our conversation with Doug Cower of Cower Guitars and Titan Guitars. Thanks for listening, everyone. Doug, how are you?
I'm excellent. How about you, bud?
I'm all right. So we share a little commonality in our Sacramento connection. I grew up in Sacramento. You grew up around that area. Where'd you grow up exactly?
Elk Grove specifically. So it's hard to tell now because they look like they're the same city, but we're basically where Sacramento ends in the south, Elk Grove starts.
Yeah.
So right there.
And your family has a cabinetry business?
Yep. Yeah, I grew up doing it with my dad. My parents are from the Bay Area, and they moved down to Elk Grove in 1980 when they got married, because even in 1980, they couldn't afford to live in the Bay Area.
Sure.
And my dad was actually a parts guy. He was a parts manager for Stockton Dotson at the time, and started getting into woodworking as kind of a hobby, and then decided he didn't like working for other people and turned the woodworking thing into a full-time job. And I think I was probably 5 or 6, you know, maybe somewhere around there when he, maybe a little bit older when he went full time, but I remember even pretty young, like it was in our garage first. There's a great picture of me at like 5 years old with earmuffs bigger than my head, catching crown molding coming out of a shaper.
Yep.
In a garage. It had a really cool 72 Blazer at the time. It was in the background. So that's a doubly cool photo for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's doing cabinet work still, and that's what I grew up doing. And then I just kind of fell into guitar building, and I'm still falling into it, apparently.
Now, did you like think this was going to be your career? Just, you know, straight out of high school?
No way. No, I was adamant that I was never going to be self-employed.
Okay.
I went through it with my parents, and I was like, nope, not going to be self-employed. That sucks. And then I was actually working towards my teaching credential, and when I built my first guitar, but I had started building kind of more seriously, and my wife at the time was closer to finishing than I was. So I went back to work. We got married and bought a house, and she finished her credential, and I started building more and more guitars. And when the recession hit, I kind of went full time because there wasn't much else to do. And honestly, as much as I would still love to teach, like, she had been teaching long enough by that point that dealing with parents and administrators kind of soured me on it. Like, I was kind of like, well, I kind of like what I do. And even though, honestly, dealing with some customers is probably worse, I reserve the right to cancel people's orders and no longer deal with them.
Sure.
And I don't get paid, it's kind of one of those things. And I get to do a lot of volunteer work. My wife's school is very tech. Well, it's not. It has a very good tech program. I won't say the school's tech oriented, but so I get to do a lot of cool stuff with their students, and who are all smarter than I am. And then there's another high school that was actually right next around the corner from my old house, and they had a really good woodworking program. And I've known them a long time because they bought a lot of our old equipment over the years as we've gone up in equipment size. So I've known the shop teacher forever, and they actually started a guitar building program. It's kind of just build Strats and Tellies, and he kind of turns the kids loose on it. But they make their bodies and their necks and paint them. So I go over there and help when I can, which actually the last couple of years I haven't had time, which is kind of sad. But my longest running employee came from that program, and he's phenomenal. So that's been kind of great.
Yeah. So you alluded to that first guitar way back when. What was it? What style?
It was basically a PRS. It was a pretty straight PRS copy, walnut body, maple top. It was the maple that came into the shop that was abnormally nice for what we get at the shop at the time when I was still working for Dad. And it was too nice to turn into like crown molding or whatever it was supposed to be. And so I made a kind of traced out Paul Reed Smith on the generic CAD program that I had at the time, and went from there. I had a Warmoth neck. I didn't want to make the neck, and it was neat. It was a nice guitar. I actually got it up in plane, and then I got it through color and sealer, and then I moved on to something else. And the body is still sitting at the shop as a reminder of one of these days maybe I should put it back together or do something, but it was neat. It was two P90s, and it's actually kind of the irony is it was linear chamber where I had just kind of slot style weight relief chambers. And when I was doing the belly cut on the backside, I ran the belly cut, and then I was like, I want to go a little deeper, and I ran it, and it ran right into the chambers. And so it had these three slots that exposed on the back, and I knew there was no way I could plug them with walnut, and it would look like anything other than a mistake. And so I actually plugged in with maple to make it look intentional, and that three-line logo actually became our logo ever since. So it's on all of our truss rod covers, and it's kind of hidden somewhere on a guitar or somewhere. So almost all my cool details are mistakes.
Yeah, that was kind of the Bob Ross method, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But it was pretty, for a first guitar, it was a carved top. It was surprisingly... I won't say it was a real complicated build for how little compared to where we're at now on the CNC, a lot of the workarounds and hacks that I did on that machine, I learned with that first guitar, and it was surprisingly decent.
And had you had no formal guitar training, no books, no anything? This is probably pre-YouTube even.
Yeah. I mean, I guess YouTube was around, but I just kind of took a stab at it. I tinkered on my own guitars growing up. And my father-in-law did repair work, so he did like light-duty repair work, like refrets and pickups and stuff for like a local guitar store in the 70s when he did it for Klein's Music.
Sure.
There by Sac City, yeah. He did that when he was going to Sac City before he took kind of the same roundabout path. He was actually an aviation mechanic at Sac City, and then he went to becoming a teacher full-time and taught elementary school instead, because if you screw up a kid, they get like 100 more chances, but if you screw up an airplane, it kind of falls from the sky. A little less stress.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it, yeah.
I kind of went through the same arc. I was so obsessed with airplanes growing up, and I knew that there was no way I was going to be an F-15 pilot. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll work on airplanes. And I had that same epiphany, and I was like, no, I'm good. I'll stick to things that can coast to a stop.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just I learned fretwork and stuff and wiring from him. But mostly on that first guitar, it was just me. I didn't make my first what became the Banshee was the first thing I ever built completely from scratch. Neck, fretwork, made a fretboard, did all of that. And that was probably, I think I had made maybe a half a dozen Strats and Tellys between those two points. And mostly buying the necks at that, you know, for Strats and Tellys. Kind of the natural arc, it seems like everybody goes on. That's like the bread and butter guitar to make. And then I made the Banshee, I made a Firebird copy the first time because I liked Firebirds, and it was another one of those surprisingly complex things to bite off for doing on the CNC, especially with the scarf joint and the neck through body and all that stuff. And honestly, we still make the guitar pretty much exactly the same way today. Wow. It's just a lot better fixtures and jigs over the last 9 years.
So were you using a CNC kind of from the get-go?
Yep. Yeah, I've never built a guitar without one.
Wow.
And I would have gotten into building guitars had my dad not had one for cabinet work. He bought his... We were like the first cabinet shop really in the area to go to CNC equipment. So a computerized saw, computerized router, point-to-point router. Dad caught on to that pretty early. So we bought ours in 99, which is not early in terms of, you know, CNCs, I guess, but for cabinet shops. And that was when I was still in high school. In 99, I was taking AutoCAD in high school. And they were basically very similar. The CAD program that the CNC provided you with was just a really dumbed down version of AutoCAD. And so it was kind of natural. I did a lot of dad's, you know, like he'd have to make a balance or a curved piece for somebody, and I did all those drawings. And then so doing that on the CNC was a real natural fit for me. I could do it by hand, I suppose, but I would probably still want a CNC just to make the templates. So kind of handicapped that way, I guess.
So you've got a handful of models under the Kaur brand, and then the one model under the Titan brand. This is kind of foreign to me. So what does the guitar design process look like when you're going straight to CNC at first?
So I draw in, I still do it in AutoCAD. I never learned 3D, so I pretty much strictly draw in AutoCAd. And it's kind of a funny process. Like, design's really, it's a mixed bag for me. It's tough in most regards, but then when it's coming together, the best way I can describe this is like, this happens almost every time. Thursday morning, I woke up. I had an idea in mind for something that I've been kind of brewing, and I think I've drawn twice now and wasn't happy with it, but I just woke up in the morning and was like, oh, okay, I know how I want to make this thing work. And we designed a whole new model, and by Saturday, I had the first body off the machine. Not a whole new model. It's a scaled up, different, tweaked version of Starliner, but like a big, big hollow body version. And it kind of seems to be that's how it works for me. Like, when I Banshee and Daylighter started pretty much, you know, early on. Daylighter is a Jazzmaster-ish thing. The original is a carved top, kind of Les Paul meets a Jazzmaster. Banshee was obviously a Firebird, and, you know, at the time, pretty much a copy. And I only say that now because at the time, there was no legal issues on copying the Firebird. That came much later.
Okay. We can get to that, yeah.
Yeah. But like Starliner, our single cut, I think that thing I drew 4 times over a year, and I just couldn't get it the way I wanted it. And finally, I just like deleted all the drawings, and in 20 minutes, it existed. Like, it just, I don't know. I could never work, like, you couldn't give me a book deal and then ask me to write 9 more books because it would be like, oh, sure. They happen when they happen. And even Titan was kind of like that. Titan actually came together pretty quick, but it's a series of ideas I've been kicking around for months or years on other things that didn't quite work. And then that was the platform that they all kind of came together on really nicely.
Yeah. But you're actually, I mean, are you holding like an electronic stylus when you're drawing out these body shapes or something else?
Just straight up right on the screen. And then most of the lines are just splines, and we Okay, we use AutoCAD, and then I have a laser that runs in Corel, and I have Photoshop, and I have like one other program, and I'm not good at any of them. Sure. just do enough of each program to be dangerous, I guess. but most time, I just draw them on the screen with the mouse, and use arcs and splines and curves, and the one thing about the CNC that's really nice, especially when I was starting off early on, before you can kind of get a The digital version of drawing is kind of tough to get a feel for proportions. And the nice thing about the CNC, you'd be like, okay, I wonder how big this actually feels. And you just go cut an outline out of like whatever scrap was laying around. And the nice thing about sharing the business with, or the shop space with my dad still, is there's always scrap, like, you know, pieces of melamine or plywood or whatever laying around. And I can go cut a full size, just quickie outline of whatever body shape I'm thinking, or whatever neck headstock profile. And I can kind of get a sense for that, and they go, ah, okay, this is too big or too small or too wide over here, and then go back and tweak it. It's going faster now after all these years. I kind of have a little bit more sense for proportion, but like Paul Roney, who used to share the shop space with me, he had a graphic design kind of background, so that it comes a lot faster to him. The manufacturing end of it was always my kind of specialty for that.
Yeah. And so you share a space with your dad's operation, mm-hmm. and how many folks actually work on Kaur guitars and Titan right now?
Two full-time and one part-time guy.
Okay. And how many guitars are you putting out a month?
It kind of varies. Right now, we try to average two or three a week for Kaur, or at least get that many done. It depends on if they're inventory or custom orders. When it slows down a little bit on the inventory side, or sales side will tend to slow the inventory side down a little bit. But, you know, like three a week's pretty comfortable for us. And we work basically a 10-month year. That's between shows and events and family stuff or whatever. If we do three a week, 3 to 5 a week, 15 a month, you know, I always think that we're doing 120 guitars a year, but I don't think we actually do that many. I think we average about 90, 80 to 90 for Kaur. And then Titan, we're already at serial number, I think we're almost at 80 already. And that starts from June of last year, when we were doing the kind of the prototype-y pre-production side of it. We've done a lot of those already.
Yeah. Well, talk to me a little bit about, you know, the origin of Titan and sort of the business model there, because for folks who don't know who might be listening, it's pretty unique.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, so one of my guys, Ben, who works for me, he does the assembly. He's been bugging me for years. So we got to build a guitar for $1,000 or sell it for $1,000. We'll sell so many of them. I was like, we just can't do it. We just can't. The average Kaur is $3,500. Or at least the average popular Kaur. We make stuff that's way worse than that. And we just couldn't come up with a way of doing it. And then about almost 2 years ago now, I went down for a small builders conference with Bob Taylor, and we were going through the Taylor factory, and it's like the way I describe it is like, I don't know if it's like you get excited to see the scope of that operation or just crushed.
Yep.
You know? Like you kind of feel good about yourself, and then you're like, oh my God. And then, I came back from it. I was like, you know, they have an entire factory dedicated to build just their two cheapest guitars. And I was like, but it kind of planted the seed. And at that point, about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, we were in a little different situation. So we started down the kind of chasing down, well, how much of the guitar can we make versus how much can we sub out? Because I know we can't do all of it. That's if we do all of it, then it's a Kaur and it's going to be $3,500. And we kind of looked at it from all the different angles and how much was I willing to give up. And two things clicked into place that really made this work was we got hooked up with Grover Jackson. And there was a lot of companies we looked at for maybe doing the necks and companies we've dealt with for other things before Kaur guitars in the past. But I just wasn't really happy with any of them. And Grover, obviously Grover's a solid bet right there. And then I knew how they were going to make the necks. I knew the necks were going to be plecked, so we wouldn't have even if we had to come back and occasionally retweak one, we should never have a neck that showed up to us with a big hump in it. That the pleck was the final quality control on it. And so that was a big key to getting the cost down. Was with the, you know, I have the equipment and the space, but we don't have the people to make like five necks a day. And sure. And that's really what we would have to do for Titan. We would need to have a lot of necks made at one time, and we could do it, but we couldn't make any cowers at the same time. And so that part made sense. And then the other piece of the puzzle that kind of clicked into place was we really were stuck on how to finish the guitars. And none of the finishes we had worked with previously were fast enough, frankly. We knew we were going to do a satin finish, but we couldn't get a satin that dried quick enough to keep dust out of it. And it's like, so it was kind of this mixed thing. And we, last year, around last, or I guess two Christmases ago now, right at the beginning of 2016, we started dabbling with UV cure finishes. And we kind of saw that as being the last piece of the puzzle. And we, it not only for Titan, but it really made a big difference for Cowher too. And we ended up getting a big automated curing booth. It's, you know, it's got a huge lamp, a motorized, you know, you hang the guitars in it and spins them and waves the lamp over it. And that was it. That was the final piece to make it work. Cause we could get it tightened down to where we could theoretically start with a body blank in the morning and ship that guitar by end of the day. If in theory we can do that, doesn't seem to quite be there yet, but, and you know, time-wise, that's about where it's at. So it worked out really good. And then, you know, I designed it intentionally to be a very fast to build guitar. It's really a glorified Telecaster in terms of construction. It's a Tele half bridge. It's a top loading bridge. All the electronics are on the pick guard, and we did that for two reasons. One, it makes it really easy for us to put the entire, you know, assemble all the electronics. I mean, it's you know, there's no extra like a Strat where you've got everything but the output jack, and then you got to fish the output jack through that one spot on the body, and then, you know, then wire it in. And we wanted output jack on the pick guard, no side drilling, to make the body really fast to machine and sand and paint. And then the other upside was because everything's on the pick guard, from a consumer point of view, we can sell you completely loaded pick guards that take about 6-7 minutes to trade out. And there's no wiring connection. There's like one, the ground wire is the only connection, and it's just on a generic quick connector. So it makes it really a mod-friendly guitar. You know, in the end, Titan was something we set out to do at a price point. So it was the first time we ever worked from a price backwards. Usually we design something, build it, and then kind of figure out what it's going to cost.
Yep.
And I love my Titan. Actually, I am so proud of Titan. I think Titan, if Titan ever failed, we would just gloss finish them and charge twice as much and put our name on the headstock. They're so good. It's such a great guitar. It's managed to become more than just a this is Cowher's budget line. Like, it's genuinely a phenomenally fantastic guitar. I love mine.
I love it. I love that you 2 years ago were admiring all of Bob Taylor's machinery. Now you've got the spinning UV finisher and a budget line. I mean, you're way ahead of the curve here.
You know, we're trying. It's one of the things that we realized. It's a lot of why we dropped dealers for Cowher's. It just, even though we try to do three guitars a week and do all these things, it just seems like we're kind of plateaued for sales and production at Cowher. And we would either have to really raise prices, which we have a few times over the years. We needed something on the, it's hard to sell a $4,000 guitar every week. But, you know, if we could sell one every other week and a couple Titans to fill out the mix, that would be great. If we could sell five Titans a week and two Cowers, I'd be, you know, doing somersaults around the block. yeah. You know, something to kind of hit at all price points. And two, we get, you know, a lot of people, oh, I wish I could afford a Cower. I wish I could afford a Cower. And this is as close to a Cower as we can make it, you know, as something that's what we think is a pretty affordable guitar for something made in California. And really, with Grover making the next, it's entirely made in California still. It's just subbed out a little bit.
Yeah. How did you and Grover connect?
I had a friend of mine, Sully Guitars, Sully there, and I was kind of running past him what I was thinking, because at the time we were kind of thinking about subbing out the necks and the finishing. And so I called, because it was just before we kind of got up on UV, and so I was talking to him, and he was subbing out his finish work, so I was kind of asking him who he was happy with, and I told him what we were trying to do, and he's like, well, I'm going to set you up with Grover. He's good friends with Grover. He says, I think Grover's going to be your guy. And I was like, I didn't know Grover did OEM work at the time.
Yeah.
And so it worked out great. And then we ended up, he just does the next and we do the finishes now, which is the right blend. That's where we kind of wanted to be anyway. But yeah, it worked out great. I was really grateful for that recommendation. And then I ended up, Grover's amazing, like a kindred spirit. Like we took NAMM off, not this last NAMM, but the year before, to kind of save that money to put towards getting Titan off the ground. But I went down for NAMM for the day, and then spent the next day with Grover at his shop, figuring if I'm going to be kind of married to him, I might as well spend a day with him. And came back, I was like, I love this guy. He's my favorite dude ever.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nice. And you mentioned that you kind of pulled the Cowers out of stores. I want to talk to you a bit about that and just the rationale there. And is that working for you?
Yeah, I think it's been the right move. I can commiserate with dealers that it's a very difficult thing to run a retail outfit. I know it's hard. And when we started up, when I was at the height before the recession, there was four cabinet shops on the block we're on. There was us and three other shops. And we all kind of did our own thing, and we all would kind of like – one specialized in commercial work, and one was kind of more track work and that kind of stuff. And so when we'd get phone calls that wasn't really our fit, we would happily send them to other – you know, the other shops. And I kind of always looked at dealers that way. I was like, you know, I want to support stores. I want to support, you know, small businesses. And it just became really at our expense every time. Not always – not every – okay. Most of the time. We had a few dealers that were genuinely really good, and we've kept a couple of them. But the most part, we couldn't really seem to get into the stores we wanted to be in. So we were always kind of in the next tier down, and some of those stores would come and go. And when they would go, it would really hurt us.
Sure.
And that same thing was just – we got to the – and this is before I had the crew I have now mostly. But we just couldn't build enough guitars to make it profitable. We just – not without really raising our prices above where I thought they should be at. You know, they're already kind of expensive. I don't want them to be that much worse than they are now. And it just got really hard. And the other problem for us was we make most of our stuff's pretty unique. So it seemed like we never had the right guitar at the right store. It was, you know, we don't do blonde Telecasters. We do – even the stuff that we make that's pretty popular – the same finish may only happen twice a year on that model, or three times a year. So it's always kind of – so as much as I want to put blame on the dealers, a lot of us, we just were a bad fit for stores. Titan might be a little bit better in that regard, but it was just kind of nice to go back to direct. And I really enjoy having the direct relationship with the customer who ends up owning our guitars. We didn't see any dip in sales. Actually, our sales have come up pretty consistently every year since we stopped doing dealers. And that may be more – there's lots of factors in that. But it seems to have been the right move for us at the time. You know, it certainly kept 30 or 40% more money in our account. And that made a big difference for us, especially to get something like Titan off the ground. You know, we need it. We can't survive on just Titans alone right now, and we can't survive on just Cowers alone, and or we kind of barely can. So that really helped.
But. Yeah. There are lots of guitar builders saying those same sentiments right now about orders and everything. Do you feel like the market's kind of improving?
Let's quantify this a little bit. Up through the end of last year was our best year. The last 3 years have been great growth years for us. I think we've made a lot of right decisions and a lot of right moves. And like I said, Cowher has not drastically increased in sales year to year. I think we went from like 65 to almost 75 to I think we did about 83 last year Cowher sales outright. And then we have some orders that fall into this year. I think it's been great. This year is not off to the start that I'd like to see it be. It's definitely a lot slower than it was this time last year, but it's hard to predict. And a lot of that's probably tax season. I hope. If I'm right, then it'll be great in about another 6 weeks. If I'm wrong and it's not great in 6 weeks, then we'll see. But I think it's been I don't know. It's been good for us.
Yeah. Well, and you've got the Titans too. Have those kind of stayed steady, or did they hit a dip in this year as well?
They were really great for pre-orders, and it's tough because it looks like we're still selling a lot of Titans, but it's mostly because we've still, I think we're shipping the last four pre-orders this week.
Yeah.
And they were like, they're the ones that were international orders, and so when the Rosewood rules changed, we decided to make their necks with Wenge, so we had to make necks for them, and to not use Rosewood on those, and so there's been some outside factors on that, but it hasn't been rip-roaring the last about 6 weeks, or I guess we're about maybe 8 weeks since NAMM now. But that's not out of the normal for us. Like when Banshee V2 came out post-lawsuit, we sold a bunch in the first month, and then we didn't sell any for literally not one for 9 months. And then it went to be our best seller consistently after that. So it seems like we get kind of like the early adopter rush, and then it kind of, you know, settles out a little bit, and then hopefully it'll start picking up again over the next probably, I think we'll start seeing it really pick up in about 3 months, 2 to 3 months here.
Yeah. Are you having the BBC dad moment right now?
Yeah, that's exactly what, yeah, so you can hear that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got the door locked, but yeah.
Do you need to go address that, or you want to stay?
No, that's fine. They'll tire themselves out, or I'll text my wife.
There's no bandsaws nearby or anything they could turn on.
Oh no, I'm home. I came home to do.
So you mentioned you can't mention lawsuit without me having a follow up question, which is just like when you went back and forth, and maybe you're not allowed to talk about it, maybe you are, I don't know. But what changes did you actually incorporate to kind of make this guitar new?
Yeah, well we could talk about it. We actually ended up pretty amicably with Gibson on that. And it gave me the chance to do what I wanted to do with that guitar. But before they sent me the cease and desist, if we had made any changes to that thing, no one would take it. You know, and now I was like, well, this is the version I always wanted to make, and I don't have a choice. And so it seemed to, you know, be fine. It's not an issue now. But if you stack the line drawings, and this is kind of what we ultimately had to do with Gibson, they actually don't share any common points. All the waistlines, the curves, cutaways, all of them are different. I mean, obviously, it's still inspired by a Firebird, but there's more mass on the body end. The waistline's different. The lower horn's different. The upper horn's different. The cutaways are different. The control spacing is wider than an original Firebird, which is, especially if you've ever had to work inside a Firebird cavity, my assembly guy loves me for that. They were just so jammed together in there. One of the things with when we kind of went through this was, obviously our headstock's different, our inlays are different, the pickguards are different. One of the debates or with trademark was, could it be pawned off as a Gibson product, and with simple changes? And that was a lot of the design factors. You can't. I mean, you would have to completely cut that guitar apart and reshape it. Plug holes and move things around, and it's just not going to be something that could easily be passed off as a counterfeit Gibson, essentially. And that helps with the case too on it for doing it. But yeah, it's quite a bit different. Some of the aspects are ironically a little closer to maybe the original 63, 64 Firebird, mostly the upper horn. They were a little more square on those earlier models. And there's actually, I think, to me, almost a little bit of Gibson RD influence that kind of wandered in a little bit there, especially on like the butt of the guitar and some of the waistline stuff. But I'm really happy with it. Like if we have a, you know, like a Banshee V1, that's one of my original guitars I built years and years ago, and you hang it next to V2 and it really makes V1 look frumpy. So I feel like I did the right thing.
Good.
It's not personal bias at all.
Yeah. I mean, so many guitars, you know, have that strong, you know, they're either Telecaster or Strat clones or Les Paul clones, or they're inspired by a Firebird or Explorer. Have there been any models that you've really desperately wanted to put out that just, you know, were totally original, no one would think anything, but you just thought the market, you know, is just too conservative for that?
Yes and no, I guess. Well, okay, Starliner is completely an original Cowher design.
Yep.
It's 100% us. It's not, I mean, obviously, it's a single cut with a set neck, so it's in the LP camp, but it's completely our design. It's our least popular seller. It's it's really frustrating in that regard. Like, the new flat top version, which we call Express, with a new pickguard that we did last year, that's finally kind of caught on, and that's I think we sold maybe a dozen of those last year, and Banshee we sold 65 of them last year. You know, Banshee just kind of crushes everything else.
Yeah.
As far as really really radical original work, I don't have anything on the books right now, just because I think the market's beat it into my consciousness that we're just not those guys. That every time we've tried, it just hasn't gone well for us.
Is that frustrating? So
it's really frustrating. Absolutely. Yeah. Acadian and Crusader, which are also based on the Starliner shape, they just didn't catch it all. Crusader was our 7-string fan fret model. And it was maybe too conservative looking as a 7-string and too wild as a, I don't know. It was somewhere in the middle. It was a really neat guitar, and Acadian, too, people who played them loved them. But I think we sold two of each. You know, I was like, yeah, that didn't work.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of really, really out there designs, though. I'm mildly conservative as designs go anyway. So, like, Starliner's not groundbreakingly original. It's definitely our thing. It is the best sounding guitar we make, though. I will say this. Starliner Semi-Hollow is unbelievable.
Yeah. All right. So,
yeah, we of the three guys, well, the four of us, so the part-time guy, three of us own Starliner Semi-Hollows. Like, they're really good. And they don't come up for sale almost ever. So I know that when the ones that have gotten into circulation, people like them. But, you know, everybody wants a Banshee. Our tourist did really well for about 2 years. It's kind of tapering off a little bit now. We've been venturing back into big Semi-Hollow stuff. Which is, that's my favorite stuff to build, so it's nice to see that catching on again. and really, honestly, who knows? Like, we could, like, when I started the Daylighter series years ago, the first one I ever built, like, the second question I ever had was, will you make a bass? And so we put it off and put it off and put it off, and finally we made a bass version of Daylighter. And it was a total flop. It just did not, like, all the people that were bugging us about it, none of them came through and bought it. And so we kind of canned it and shelved it for a few years. And then maybe the end of the year before, I was like, I really want to build a semi-hollow bass. And my father-in-law really wanted a semi-hollow bass. And so we made a semi-hollow bass version of the original Daylighter bass. And we made a couple design changes. We gave it Arcturus's headstock and pickguard. And now it's really popular. Now, I mean, it's not flying out the doors, but we've sold maybe half a dozen of those last year, which was really a surprise for us. And so who knows? If I think it's a great idea, then it's a pretty much guaranteed flop. Guaranteed. It's going to be a disaster.
All right. I know that feeling. Are you still doing the guitar racks?
Yeah, we are, actually. And those were another really smart move we made. I think that was one of the biggest parts of our growth the last 3 years. It was a $400 widget we could sell. Like, I didn't know how to make pedals, and the original way we made those racks almost 10 years ago was a disaster. Like, they're really neat, but there was too many sizes and colors, and we never really sat down and figured out how to make them quickly or efficiently, let's put it that way. About 2 years ago, we have this weird little nook in our office that's just useless. Like, it's like a 3 foot wide or 38-inch wide, it's just a hair over 3 feet corner that is kind of just been where stuff collects. And we had so many guitars going at the time. I was like, you know, I'm just gonna make one of those racks again to fit that corner. And so we made it out of just, you know, plywood. And we, from the original one to now, we had bought a laser, so we were using a laser to cut some of the parts we were struggling with before and had found some other resources. And we posted a picture on Instagram and people were like, you should make those. It's like, we do make them. We used to make them. So we kind of sat down and kind of, this is actually predates Titan. It was kind of the same boat. It's like, okay, how do I make this thing? And, you know, exactly how do I make it and market it? So it was, we made it out of solid bamboo, so we didn't it was just the one wood choice. It's one size. We, you know, had boxes designed to fit instead of having to make boxes every time. You know, found the right suppliers for a couple of the things we were really hung up on. And then it got to the point, it was like that old adage about, you know, airlines are trying to save money and they take one peanut out of each bag, mm-hmm. and they save, you know, $1 million a year kind of thing. It's like, well, if we go down one screw, we get, you know, it got a little over the top there. but they're great. We make a run. The only downside is it takes the four of us. It basically shuts the shop down for about a week and a half. So we'll do a run about every 6 weeks. We'll cut, machine, sand them all out, and that's about 3 days of work. And then they go over to the finishers, because we use the same finisher that does Dad's cabinet work for that stuff. And then when they come back about a week later, then we have about 3 or 4 days of felt and inserts and boxing and packing everything up. But it's a great product, and once it's all boxed up and everything, it's great. We you know, it's nice to wake up and see two orders came in, or an order came in overnight, and slap a label on it, send it on its way, and it's been very, very well received. And the fact that they stack is really nice.
Yeah.
I know Adam at Satellite is going to be the first person in history with a three-level version.
Okay. Yeah.
He's got like a 14-foot ceiling in his place, and he's like, can you make me another set of the tall sides that will let me stack in three levels? I'm like, yes, I can.
Wow.
I just can't wait to see that one. That's going to be great.
Next, he'll just need that little ladder on rollers like at the bars of libraries. Yeah.
Yep. So that's been a great product for us. And so now we have, you know, that was kind of thing. When we realized about 3 years ago where we were kind of capped, you know, it was like if we had a $400 product and an $800 product and a $1,200 product, Titan now, and then, you know, Kaur kind of technically starts at about $1,950 to $2,000, but really most of the Kaurs that are popular are about $2,900 to $3,900. But, you know, try to hit stuff at all price points and hopefully kind of, I don't know, I guess it's the luthier's version of diversifying your stocks, right?
Yeah. Smart. Not many do that. Yeah, I'm impressed. Are there plans for more Titans or different models?
No. Well, yes and no. There are definitely going to be different models, but I think Titan's life is going to be, we're going to make the KR1 until we feel like nobody wants it anymore, and then we're going to stop, and then we'll bring out the next version of it, the KR2 or whatever it's going to become, and then maybe that'll be a double cut with a trim, and we make that for 2 or 3 years, and then, I mean, I would be thrilled if KR1 never died off, if people always bought them.
Yeah.
That would be great. But, you know, if they run their course after about 2 or 3 years and we feel like it's time to maybe make something else for a while, I think that's how it's going to go. The main thing with Titan for us is we have to say no a lot on that brand. Like, it only works because we make – if we were Bob Taylor, we had a factory dedicated to making just those and there was the sales to support it, then we would make the KR1 forever.
Sure.
And we'd make 6 versions of the KR1 and then, you know, or whatever. And then it ends up just becoming a Kaur again. But the way we do it right now, because the bodies are all the same and the necks are all the same, we basically fit them in the gaps in our kind of normal production schedule, because the CNC doesn't run every day of the week. We really run it pretty hard. It maybe gets 8 hours of use a week. You know, we run a bunch of bodies or we run a bunch of fretboards. That's a pretty busy day. If we run fretboards, we typically do 3 months worth of fretboards over about 3 days. And then, you know, so a lot of times what we'll do is we'll keep a stack of body blanks for Titans. And if one of the guys has a slow day, he'll go make another dozen Titans. And if I have a week where I don't really have any Kaurs hit the booth, I'll just paint Titans for the week. And so we've been able to, especially leading up to NAMM, we spent 6 months just whenever there was a gap in the schedule, we would roll a rack full of 5 Titans in the booth, you know, paint them one all the same color, and then stick them up in the storage cabinets. And then, and because they're universally routed, there was no real dedication. Like, if you order a Banshee, it's dedicated to whatever you ordered it as. Titan is, there's 5 color choices. That's about the biggest option. And then there's pickguard options and a million pickup options. But the pickups don't really bother us because we just order them as we need to. And the pickguards, we make them in bulk ahead of time. And then we just route the pickups out as the orders come in. So we were able to keep that kind of light on its feet. So that works pretty well. But if we get to the point where it doesn't work, if we have to make two kinds of bodies or offer two kinds of necks, because then we've just halved our inventories all the time. And that's the classic trap Cower falls into. And every Cower we've ever tried to do this with, like Arcturus came out at 1950 with a Tele half bridge, and it was supposed to be our you know, streamlined mass production guitar. And within the second, third order, mastery trims became an option, and maple fretboard. You know, I was like, just the option list exponentially explodes, and that just drives the price up. We just can't do it any other way.
Sure.
So far I've been good. I kind of feel bad saying no to people, but I'm like, nah, I can't do that. I can't do that. This is kind of just what it is. But on the other side of the coin, like especially like the mastery trim, we've had a lot of people ask about that. So we went and I just drew up the routing programs in AutoCAD and we put it on the website. If you want to route your own Titan out for a mastery, we'll give you the template. So you can we'll even laser cut you a template and you are welcome to do it yourself, but we can't do it. We can't offer it.
Has anyone done that yet?
Not quite yet. I've had a few people circling on it. And maybe what we would do is if there was enough people that were like, we really want one, but if we could maybe line up 20 at one time in a one time only run, that might be something that happens down the road. But it wouldn't be something we could stock. But I'd love to see somebody route one out for a master. I think it'd be amazing. It looks cool on the AutoCAD drawing. It looks great. I'm really trying to resist doing it because it would not be an issue for us to go make one like that. But as soon as I make one, then it becomes, well, you did it once. Why can't you do it for me? And I'm like, I just can't do it. I can't go down that road. We accidentally got some reverse headstock necks. Grover, on the last batch of necks, I had him make some left-handed necks, and they forgot to reverse the inlay pattern because it's kind of an offset pattern, which we've done the exact same thing before. That's how I accidentally made our first reverse headstock neck too. And so when the neck showed up, I was like, man, I don't have the heart to tell them, but I got to get new necks made. So but they were already side dotted left-handed, so I didn't really want to sell them. So we drilled out the necks for the side dots and plugged them with some little laser cut rosewood plugs. And they look nice, but they're not necks we would ever sell. They only kind of end up with our friends. And one of our friends ended up with one last weekend, and they was like, I want a reverse headstock one. I'm like, I knew that was gonna backfire. I'm like, well, you did it once. Like, we didn't really do it once. We had them by accident.
Yes.
So, Cowers is such a sky's the limit guitar. I mean, you know, we'll do leopard print metal flake on Cower. I don't care. But we can't make – it's why Cowers we just can't make stuff ahead of time like that. They're the two opposite ends of the spectrum, I hope, this way.
Yeah. Are you a big guitar collector outside of your own creations?
I have lots of stuff I would love to have. Yeah. And if I didn't do this for a living, I probably would have them.
Have the means to be able to buy them, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. I've got a Huber Krauster now, which I'm thrilled about. Nick is one of the earliest supporters of mine. I met Nick years and years ago, and I've waxed poetic on many podcasts about how much I love Nick. And he really wanted a Banshee. He wanted a Pelham Blue Banshee 1, essentially, or Banshee Junior, and so we kind of just surprised him with it at NAMM a few years ago. And I think he has maybe the rarest Banshee of all, because he has the last V1, essentially, because the CD&D came down right after that, but it had the headstock that became the V2 headstock, when we were kind of experimenting with changing the headstock on it. So he's got, I think, the only one, like, there might be two like that. In the world. So his is pretty cool, or pretty rare. And then when we were at the Holy Grail Guitar Show a few years back and all my stuff got stuck in customs, Nick's kid played a gig with that guitar in, I can't exactly where we were in Germany, but it was like Frankfurt, Saturday night. And then a customer of mine picked it up from that gig and drove it to the show in Berlin for me Sunday morning, so I could have at least something to put on the table. So that kind of worked out doubly nice for me. So they surprised me with a Krauster at NAMM this year, so that was great. And I've got a Roni Marquis, which I adore. I actually bought that. I didn't get it from Paul. It went to he sold it was to a customer, and then it popped up on Reverb, and this customer reminds like, hey, tell me about this Roni. I was like, oh, it's terrible. Don't get that one. And then I turned around and bought it underneath him because I loved that guitar. It was such a great one. And I've got a Cole on the, you know, same thing. Saul's got a Banshee, and eventually in the next 20 years, I'll get a Cole.
Yeah.
Which is great, because then I'll see where I've subconsciously ripped off the next thing of ours, design-wise. Because they're all, every time I find the Cole that I didn't realize I just ripped off. He's just better than the rest of us. But I would there's tons of stuff I would love to have. I mean, there's so many guitars, which is odd, because I never get time to play guitar anymore. But I would love I have a buddy in France, Mikhail Springer, whose work I just adore. It's hard to make this list and not get everybody and offend people, but I'd love a Cardinal. I'd love I think Claudio Pagelli. I don't even play archtops, and I would kill for one of his archtops.
Sure.
And there's a healthy amount of his influence on our guitars too. Actually, I've met him before, but we were talking at NAMM 3 years ago, and he gave me the compliment of all compliments. He goes, we were looking at this one of mine. He was very complimentary about everything. He was like, this looks like something I would have designed. And I was like, yes, that's the compliment I've always wanted to hear.
That's nice.
Unless you mean, this looks like something you've ripped off from me, and then I'm very sorry. But there's so much stuff. But it's, you know, the funny thing is, it's very, almost none of it's on the vintage end. I almost don't care at all about vintage guitars. Like, I mean, there's some vintage stuff I would love to own for the sake of owning it, like Guild Starfires from the 60s. I love Guild Starfires a lot.
Sure.
I'd love to have a white. Actually, I don't know if I'd rather have a white Falcon or a white Penguin. I think I'd rather have a white Penguin. You know, some of the cooler Gretsch stuff. And I like to have a 59 Burst just to pay my house off. That'd be sure. Fine. I don't really want it for any other reason than that. But I really, the vintage stuff just doesn't do it for me anymore. I'm just not interested in it. It's, I mean, without sounding contrite, it's kind of been there, done that for me. I kind of want the stuff that nobody else has or a few other people have. Mm-hmm. And I just want to support my buddies. And that's part of why I want their stuff so bad.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Maybe one day I'll grow up and get a real job and I can afford lots of guitars.
You guys also have a podcast. I know you're not on it every week, but you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I get to crash host the Luthierist, which Paul Roni started, and now Paul and Soli are doing, or have been doing together for a long time. And so I kind of force my way in there and occasionally guest host, or mostly just make dumb Simpsons jokes that only I understand. And like three other people in the group seem to understand. Or worse yet, I get kind of drunk and make promises then people call me up on. Like, I think one time I was on there, and it was right before NAMM, and I made a remark about, if somebody ever mailed me a letter, I'd probably just give them a guitar, and then somebody did.
Got to make it a little harder for these people.
It was like, you got me on that one. And it was a pretty good customer of mine, so he's getting something. He just doesn't know what yet.
All right.
But that's a pretty fun one, so.
Well, cool, Doug. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you. I've been reading fretboard journals since maybe pretty close to issue one, like a long time. So I was very excited to do this.
Thank you so much. All right. Till next time.